The WORT Board of Directors will hold its regularly scheduled meeting on Wednesday, April 17th at 6 p.m. in person at the station, 118 South Bedford Street. The public is welcome to attend. Meeting attendance is also available via Zoom. For information on how to attend this meeting virtually, please email president@wortfm.org.
And welcome to Her Turn, a program of news and information from a feminist perspective. I'm Eliza Howard.
And I'm Garima Gupta. On today's program, Arizona continues attack on women by reverting to a law way before its statehood.
Poland begins debating their near-total abortion ban.
Have you done your taxes? We will hear from an expert on why tax fairness is a feminist issue.
And recent federal budget debates have shifted focus to women and families. So stay tuned for all this and more on this April 14th, 2024 edition of Her Turn. Republican lawmakers in Arizona have blocked efforts by Democrats to repeal an 1864 law that bans nearly all abortions. In the Arizona State Supreme Court, five of its seven justices chosen by the previous Republican governor reverted Arizona to this 160-year-old law that was put in place before women could vote and before Arizona was a state. OBGYN, abortion provider and CEO of the nonprofit Desert Start Institutes for Family Planning, Dr. Deshaun Taylor, said, quote, "What this means is that people will not get their needed abortions in Arizona. These laws carry prison time," end quote. Arizona Abortion Access has been gathering signatures to put a state constitutional amendment on abortion on Arizona's November ballot. The coalition has amassed over 500,000 signatures, with the goal of collecting over double the required number of signatures of almost 400,000 by July 3rd. Chris Love from Arizona Abortion Access said, quote, "I think Arizona voters truly believe that our judges have gone too far, and they need to have the say at the ballot box," end quote.
Poland has begun debating reforms to their near-total abortion bans. These debates come 3 years after the country was rocked by mass protests. Dorota Olko of the Left Together Party had this to say. "Removing the provisions on imprisonment for assisting in abortion from the penal code is the first necessary step to the safety of pregnant women in our country. The place of abortion is in the medical textbook, not in the criminal record."
On March 20th, 2024, United Nations Women, in partnership with UNDP, UNFPA, and OHCHR, gathered partners to discuss strategies for advancing gender equality, human rights, and democracy at the 68th session of Commission of the Status of Women. Across the globe, speakers shared examples of their work on feminist movement and highlighted the importance of working together to counter backlash, reform laws, and support women's movements.
On Wednesday, April 10th, head of USAID Samantha Powers became the first top Biden administration official to publicly acknowledge that famine is present in northern Gaza. While being questioned by House Democrat Joaquin Castro, Powers said, quote, "In northern Gaza, the rate of malnutrition prior to October 7th was almost zero and is now one in three kids."
In recent federal budget debates, the focus has turned to decisions that directly impact women and families. In President Biden's proposed 2025 budget, there's a focus on ensuring that big corporations pay their share of taxes and families are given more support and relief. This budget will invest in affordable childcare, paid family leave, and overall better health care. It supports programs like WIC that help women and kids get healthy food and fundings for other needs. On the other hand, House Republicans' budget will cut trillions from programs that help needy families like nutrition assistance and giving more tax breaks to big corporations. They also want to create a fiscal commission to make it easier to cut Social Security and Medicare, which could really hurt women and people of color. As per the National Women's Law Center, it's high time that the government focuses on investments in healthcare, childcare, aging, and disability care to make life better for women and families.
It's a simple matter of fairness. Those who can afford to pay more should pay more, right? Well, not when it comes to big corporations that pay their CEOs more than they pay in taxes. A new report is documenting the problem and proposes some solution. Sarah Addison from the Institute for Policy Studies is the co-author of the study. Her turn reporter, Arlene Zouka, has more.
You're one of the authors of a new study called More for Them, Less for Us. And in your report, you say that big profitable corporations don't pay their fair share of taxes and that underpaid corporate taxes and overpaid executives are related. Can you tell us about that and give us some specific examples from the report?
Absolutely. Well, most people know that big corporations are not paying their fair share of taxes, but this report exposes just how bad the problem really is by revealing that a significant number of profitable corporations are actually paying less in federal income taxes than they're paying a handful of top executives. We found 35 profitable corporations that paid their top five executives more than they paid in taxes between 2018 and 2022. And as for examples, the one that a lot of people are focusing in on is Tesla. Over that five-year period, the electric car maker raked in $4.4 billion in profits, but wound up paying no federal income taxes. And meanwhile, of course, Tesla CEO Elon Musk became one of the world's richest men.
It seems that people are more focused on the price of groceries than they are on this issue of money for the big corporations and the wealthy CEOs. So how exactly does this impact the rest of us, this system?
Well, it means that the people who are at the top of our economic ladder are not paying their fair share of all the revenue needed to invest in our nation's infrastructure, our public services, all the things we need for our economy to thrive. They're really sticking the rest of us with the bill. And I know you're particularly interested in the feminist angle on this, and there's a really strong one because tax is a feminist issue for two reasons. One is because it really favors the wealthy and large corporations, and the people who benefit from that tend to be men. I mean, just to give you one sense of how skewed things are, in 2022, Fortune magazine announced with great fanfare that for the first time in history, 10% of CEOs among Fortune 500 companies were women. And that was supposed to be, you know, something really to celebrate. Well, that still leaves 90% of CEOs at these large companies being men. And our report shows how big corporations often get away with paying next to nothing in taxes and how their executives and their wealthy shareholders benefit from that. But another way that the tax code favors the ultra wealthy that really should be mentioned is on the individual tax side. Our current system taxes income from investments at a much lower rate than we tax income from work. So currently the top tax rate on the richest Americans is 37%, but the rate on their long-term investment earnings is just 20%. And that's why we have rich people, even billionaires like Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk, often taxed at a lower rate than nurses, teachers, flight attendants, and so forth. Then the second reason is when the wealthy and corporations are not paying their fair share of taxes, this contributes to pressure to cut social spending on things like education, healthcare, and vital services. And this has a disproportionate impact on women who tend to shoulder the responsibility of unpaid labor, taking care of children, elderly family members. They also spend a larger share of their income on food and basic goods for their households. So there are different ways that the tax code could really be improved to reduce gender inequality and economic inequality as well.
This isn't a new problem, but you say it's getting worse. And one of the reasons that you document is that the Trump tax cut from 2017 has made it worse. And yet there's a disconnect there in some ways because polls show that people think Trump is so much better on the economy. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, it is tough. I mean, you said at the beginning that people are really focused on the price of groceries going up, and I totally understand that. I have stickers. Shock when I go to the store sometimes these days. But the bigger picture is really how much of our nation's wealth is being made off by those at the top. That's why it's hard for people to afford these rising prices because they're not seeing the increase in their incomes and they're seeing rising costs, both in housing and other things, and their incomes are not keeping pace. And one part of that bigger context is in 2017, there were the Republican tax cuts that slashed the corporate rate from 35 to 21%. And a lot of companies said, hey, if you do that, you lower our tax burden. We're going to put that money into raising worker wages and giving everybody bonuses. But that's not what happened. Instead, they took the windfalls from the corporate tax rate and funneled it into the pockets of their top executives. One way they did that was by spending a record amount, $1 trillion in 2018 on stock buybacks, which is just a way of artificially inflating the value of their shares. And executives benefit from that because they get most of their pay and some kind of stock-based pay. And so the tax cuts of 2017 have not translated into higher wages or better opportunities for most U.S. workers. And that's why we're feeling the pinch at the gas pump and at the grocery store so much more.
Let's talk a little bit about solutions. President Biden's budget includes a call for increased corporate taxes and also taxes on billionaires. What do you think of his proposal?
Yeah, well, I'm quite encouraged by things that he said during the State of the Union. He made this a really big issue. He said it was his goal to make big corporations and the very wealthy finally begin to pay their fair share. He talked about raising up the minimum tax that corporations have to pay, which would help address the issues we raised in our report about so many companies not paying anything in taxes. They would have at least a minimum rate that they would have to pay. And then I think his billionaire tax idea is really good too. It is just downright obscene that people who have more money than they'll ever be able to spend are paying so little in taxes because of the way our system is set up now, where if you are getting the bulk of your wealth from investments instead of your salary, your paycheck, like most rich people are, you are paying a lower rate than ordinary Americans. And his billionaire tax would zero in on the very, very richest who've done extremely well throughout the pandemic. Their wealth has been increasing, and it's really time to turn that around, because if we don't break this cycle of overpaying executives and underpaying taxes, we're not going to have the kind of economy that benefits all of us. We're not going to have the investments in infrastructure, education, and healthcare, which are good for everyone, including companies. They want to have a workforce to draw from that is well educated. They need to rely on a good infrastructure system. But as long as the corporate share of what's going into the public investment fund pots is declining, we're not going to be able to have that future.
Are any of these proposals realistically going to pass?
Well, that depends on a lot of things. This is a year of great uncertainty, as we all know, politically. But what the polls show is that these are not actually very partisan issues, that across the political spectrum, ideas like raising taxes on the wealthy and big corporations is wildly popular. But there is often a disconnect between how ordinary Americans think and how their leaders in Washington think. And there is often quite a lag time between when leaders in Washington get more in sync with public sentiment. But I think the way to turn that around is to just keep raising these issues. Spotlight is going to be on candidates running for office this year, and taxes should really be at the center of that debate.
You've been working on these issues for a while now. How do you keep your hopes up? Because so many folks I know are just so discouraged and disaffected with our whole political process.
I guess having my long time frame does help a bit with that, because I was working on executive pay decades ago when they would bring me on like the business TV cable shows and just totally pummel me for daring to suggest that CEOs who are laying off workers maybe don't deserve $10, $20 million a year, and that maybe CEOs aren't worth hundreds of times what ordinary workers are making. And I think that at least the public discourse has shifted quite a bit. I think the pandemic helped people understand that, look at who really kept our economy going. It was a lot of low-income workers on the front lines, making sure we had food on the table and other things to keep our economy moving. And so I think that it's been encouraging to see that public discourse shift. And then we've also seen some really positive policies in recent years. In 2022, they did pass the Inflation Reduction Act, which has a tax on stock buybacks for the first time. That gets at the CEO pay problem, because stock buybacks just inflate CEO pay and siphon resources away from worker wages. It's a tiny one, but it's a start. We also did get at least a 15% minimum tax on companies. And we're also seeing interesting innovations at the city and state level. I've helped work on taxes in both Portland, Oregon, and San Francisco, where they're putting increased taxes on companies that have big gaps between their CEO and their worker pay, and they're raising revenue from those taxes to invest in urgent social needs. And so I really cling to these signs of hope that I do see, and hope we'll see more progress in coming years.
If our listeners are concerned or want to take some action about this issue of overpaid executives and underpaid corporate taxes, do you have some suggestions for us?
Absolutely. Well, like I said, this is going to be a year of many, you know, public debates about the future of the country politically and policy-wise. Often we'll see candidates kind of riling up their base by talking about inequality and how much these CEO fat cats are making, but they don't make commitments to actually doing something about it. So I would try to hold them to those commitments. And also, if people want to just stay up on these issues, we have a free weekly newsletter through our inequality.org website. Just go to the homepage of inequality.org. You'll see a button to sign up for our free newsletter, and we'll keep you up on a constant stream of both analysis of these issues, but also ideas for action.
That was Sarah Anderson from the Institute of Policy Studies and a co-author of the new report, More for Them, Less for Us. To check out the study, you can find it at inequality.org.
For more on the abortion ban just instituted in Arizona, we're going to hear an excerpt from Democracy Now!, speaking to reproductive justice community organizer Alejandro Pablos, who was targeted by ICE for her activism and faced deportation proceedings for over a decade, as well as Phoenix physician Deshaun Taylor.
Basically, what this means is that people will not get their needed abortions in the state of Arizona. These laws carry prison time. And I, as an abortion provider, appreciate the words of our governor and our attorney general. But at the end of the day, someone has to test whether what they say they're going to do is true. So these lawmakers understand that the threatening us with prison time is very compelling and has a chilling effect. And so essentially abortions likely will not happen in Arizona because of those criminal penalties assigned to them, as we see going on across the country.
And Dr. Taylor, just to clarify, according to a survey for the Society of Family Planning, about 1,100 abortions take place every month in Arizona. Where will women go now to seek abortions?
What I want your viewers to understand is it was challenging for people to get abortions even prior to Roe v. Wade being overturned due to the web of restrictions, nearly 40 restrictions on the books in this state. And so people were already increasingly self-managing their abortions. People are already leaving our state who had the resources to do so. But the overwhelming majority of people who don't get their abortions have babies or become ill and potentially lose their lives. So what we see is these escalating things happening to our population, which are forcing people to take matters into their own hands, number one, or stay pregnant, because most people don't have the resources to leave the state for an abortion.
I wanted to bring Chris Love into this conversation. Even before the Supreme Court ruled, the state Supreme Court ruled, this coalition had formed and has been gathering signatures for a November referendum, a constitutional amendment that would guarantee the right to abortion, Arizona for Abortion Access, it's called. You have, what, 500,000 signatures? Isn't that ready to go? What are you waiting for at this point? Are you concerned that it still wouldn't get on the ballot?
So at this point, we're 3 months out from having to turn in all of our qualifying signatures. We have to turn in 384,000 valid signatures by July 3rd of this year. In Arizona, we collect far more signatures than we need because those signatures are easily challenged in our courts and sometimes thrown out. So we're aiming to collect more than double the amount to ensure that we are on the ballot in November. And, I am very confident that we will be. We've seen a groundswell of, Arizona voters who really understand that decisions about abortion should remain between a pregnant person and their medical provider and their family members if they so choose. But politicians, and especially now activist judges, have no role in that decision.
I wanted to ask Alejandra Pablos, an Arizona reproductive justice activist, does this ruling affect communities of color differently? If you can explain that. You yourself have been targeted for deportation as reproductive justice activists for a decade. But what does this particularly mean?
Thank you, Amy. Really good to be back amongst comrades that are doing great work in Arizona. Like you said, as an organizer, as somebody who's been sharing their story of being incarcerated, of being facing deportation, of having an abortion as a form of resistance, because we know where we are living and where we have been living way before Roe, the fact is that it was never enough for me and the organizing that we do as a person who's been criminalized, surveilled, right, for how I look, how I speak. We live in a country where the president doesn't, he can't even say the word abortion, right? So really, the people that are still making decisions for us don't look like us, right? So, but people like myself have been organizing for reproductive rights, fighting stigma, right? We know what we want, and we want people to have the care that they need. We know that there are so many reasons why people do not want to parent, and reproductive justice is about, you know, supporting folks who want to parent, who do not want to bear children, right? And when we do want to parent, to do it in safe and sustainable communities. Like you said, I've been facing deportation, and sometimes I feel like that's already a choice that's been taken from me, right? Because who wants to parent under this stress? And the truth is that most people of color, migrant people, young people, trans, non-binary people who have abortion and need this reproductive health care have been, right, taken this choice away from them. We don't have the resources. We've been crying out to defund the police because it is a cry to fund our communities. We are creating constantly, lawmakers are creating desperate communities, right? We're going to be forcing people to have abortions and then blaming it on us, right? And fighting stigma right now for myself is where I want to focus my energy. I think as I created a project called Abortion Showers Project, where it is led by trans people, non-binary people, people from the Americas, right? That we understand it's our responsibility to fight and to talk about abortion of care in a loving way, because we've been taking care of each other for so long. So I think that's kind of some of the work I'm focusing on right now, because again, talking about this issue in Spanish, right? The United States is made up of non-white, non-English speaking people, right? So I think that's one way that I'm really fighting to really like love on our people in this moment where there's so much violence in Arizona. So our work right now really is to keep fighting stigma, right? To keep on sharing and fighting for education that's real, that's centered in real stories. And the plain and simple matter is that there's so much racism. It is a racial justice issue, right? Who are we trying to force to have abortions? Deshaun talked about prison. We already have the highest incarceration rates in the world in Arizona. And are we going to be filling it up with pregnant people? Or is that the only place we're going to force people to have abortions? Right? It's just a really, really scary moment right now.
Democracy Now! Can be heard 5 times a week on WORT 89.9 or anytime at all on wortfm.org or democracynow.org.
I am my mother's savage daughter, the one who runs barefoot, cursing sharp stones. I will not cut my hair, I will not lower my voice. My mother's child is a savage. She looks for her omens in the colors of stones, in the faces of cats, in the falling of feathers, in the dancing of fire, in the curve of...
Sources used in today's program include Democracy Now!, MS Magazine, and uswomen.org.
Today's program was produced by Christina Kivlin. Joanne Powers was our on-air engineer. Other contributors include Garima Gupta, Eliza Howard, and Arlene Zoucha. Stay tuned for 2.5 hours of Women in Music on Her Infinite Variety with hosts Steph Stringer, Danny BR, Izzy, and Sophie. For her turn, I'm Eliza Howard.
And I am Garima Gupta. You are listening to WORT Madison. Have a feminist day.
you did, but you did, and you make it feel easy. Easy like breathing, so easy I'm freaking. I don't know what you did, but you did, and you make it feel like no one.